Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Health Media Now with award-winning author and host Denise Messenger for a lifetime of health empowerment. Live by being in the pink, meaning P stands for being persistent, I stands for using your intuition, N stands for networking, and K stands for obtaining knowledge. Preserve and protect your health by listening live every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our guests entertain and share cutting-edge information. They share with you what may have taken years to achieve through experience in their field. Become inspired and motivated. Reach your full potential with fascinating tips and products. Receive a lifetime of benefits from authors, doctors, practitioners, healthcare providers, and learn about exciting new products. You asked for it, and we deliver. Now, here's your host, Denise Messenger.
Hello, listeners. Today's February 5th, 2014. We have a really special show today. I actually have two different guests on two different subjects. Our first guest, which the interview will run about 40 minutes, is Harry Stoddart. And he is a college graduate with a BS and an MS in agricultural economics. We're going to talk today about his book, Real Dirt, An Ex-Industrial Farmer's Guide to a Sustainable Future. Then the second half of our show will be with our very special guest, Judy Breisendine. She's the author of the book Stunned by Grief and a journal Stunned. These have both won national and international book awards. So I would like to now bring Harry onto our show. Hello, Harry. So good of you to join us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
I like to start my shows out with my guests telling my listeners how you got on the path that you're on today.
It's been a long and winding journey. I graduated from university, bought my parents' farm, which was a confinement hog operation. Basically, everything that you can picture about when I say confinement animal feeding operation, that's what I owned 20 years ago. And then the hog market took a crash in 1998. We get out of the hog business. Barely hung on to the home farm. I started to transition to organic grains at that point in time, and then with a partner built a fairly significant organic grain operation. We were running about 2,000 acres when we decided to part ways, and today we've turned our land base completely over to pasture and hay, raising grass-fed beef and lamb and direct marketing that to consumers. It's been a winding road.
Certainly. Like we were talking before the show started, I have a lot of gratitude and for farmers for what it is they do, because the market can be so volatile and there's so many things that can go right or can go wrong in the farming seasons. Tell me, why did you write your book called Real Dirt? What promoted you to do this?
It started out, we were selling in farmers markets in Toronto, and we were spending a lot of our time explaining to people what was happening on the farm and helping them understand agriculture and the various issues of the day. That evolved into writing a monthly newsletter, and then at some point somebody said, you know, you've probably got content for a book there. And so I sort of consolidated some of the newsletters and started writing a book to try and give a window to people who aren't connected with the food system, some of what's going on back at the farm, and what they need to be concerned about and how they can change agriculture with their food choices.
I know. We all go to the grocery store. Rarely do we give any thought to how our food is produced. You call yourself an ex-industrial farmer? What do you mean by ex-industrial? Is that because you're doing organic or?
I think it's part of its reference to the fact when I started farming, I was as conventional as you can be. You know, we had the confinement animal feeding operation. I grew GMO crops the first year they were available to me, herbicides, fertilizers, everything in modern agriculture we were doing and using. And then, you know, over the course of about 10 years, it took us to transition all of our land-based. I switched to organic, but we were essentially industrial organic. You know, we were running big combines, big equipment, 2,000 acres. So I'd only partially transitioned from being industrial, whereas today we're focused on the health of our land, perennial cover crop, grazing animals in the environment they were intended to be in, and really taking a different approach to the way we manage our farm and produce food.
Is it true that on these large plots of land that the soil becomes depleted of minerals, so then our food has a depletion of minerals in it?
Yes. The if you look at the health of the soil today on most farms compared to what it was before that farm was broken up from the prairie or forest land, or even compared to undisturbed in fence rows, there's a substantial difference in that soil. We're degrading soil every time we till it, every time we put fertilizer on, use pesticides, we're disrupting the life in the soil, and there's an entire ecosystem in the soil that, left undisturbed, does a great job of supplying minerals to plants. But every time we disturb that soil, it's sort of like sending a hurricane through a city, except we're doing it two, three, four times a year and completely disrupting all of the microbiology and insects and fungi that live in the soil at various depths. So we're essentially farming as if the life in the soil didn't matter. We're supplying, you know, we supply the three major nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and some microbes if there's a clear deficiency. But in terms of the health of the soil, which directly relates to the health of the plants and the health of the food that we're eating, agriculture doesn't really focus on that at all at this point, which is unfortunate.
What issues came up for you as a farmer that promoted you to transition from GMOs and pesticides to organic? Were there some health issues that came up, or was it a financial decision? How did it come about?
It was primarily a financial decision. The hog market crash pushed us to the brink of bankruptcy.
Okay.
And we were looking for something that had higher margins. We had a piece of land that we picked up that could be certified organic immediately. I had a neighbor who was successfully farming organically, so the pieces kind of fell in place, and I was skeptical of the ability to farm organically initially, but we worked with a small piece and convinced ourselves that we could do it. And then gradually over time transitioned the rest of our land and started to see agriculture in a different light in terms of all the tools that we used previously and their potential harm.
Let's talk a little bit about the problems in our food supply and what solutions you have.
Okay. So from my perspective, there's sort of what I call the three major problems that agriculture is facing in the next number of years. The first one is the use of antibiotics. There's a direct connection that's been made in science research between feeding subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics. So in agriculture, the majority of the antibiotics that we use, well, I don't anymore, but I did at one point in time, are fed at a low level continuously. The animals grow a little faster, use feed a little more efficiently so that they're more profitable, but it's not being used to cure any disease. Alexander Fleming, the discoverer of penicillin, warned us in his Nobel laureate address in 1945 that if we used too low a dose of antibiotics, we would create, in his words, mutant-resistant bacteria. And then he proved it in his lab a few years later, and we've known it's been demonstrated in farm setting in research starting in the mid-1950s. So this is a no-brainer and incredibly frustrating that the powers that be, the regulators, can't get this one right. The USDA has been petitioned for over a decade to remove the approvals for these uses, and they've come back with their answer currently is create voluntary industry guidelines, which are basically meaningless from my perspective.
I thought I read something somewhere recently where they were taking it a little more seriously, the antibiotic use.
There were several, or a coalition of environment activist groups that had originally petitioned them a decade ago. And when the USDA came out with their position last year, I guess 2 years ago now, that they would just establish voluntary guidelines, those organizations then sued them in the U.S. court system, and a judge has sided with the activist group saying, no, USDA, you really need to take a look at this.
Okay.
Serious concern to the health of the American people. So they're revisiting it, but they're not. At this point, they haven't come up with anything more than the voluntary guideline.
Okay. So what else besides the antibiotic use?
The next one after that for me is the degradation of soil and soil erosion. The soil is the lifeblood of plant agriculture, and from there, animal agriculture. And when you look at a map of the world and map all of the regions of the world with some form of soil degradation, it matches up with all of the agricultural regions of the world. You can't farm the way we're farming today without degrading the soil. And soil is not something that's easily replaced. It takes a long time to build up. Some estimates say 500 years to build an inch of topsoil. And we're losing what appears to be small amounts of soil. You can't tell one year to the next, but over time it accumulates. There's a reason our rivers flow brown in the spring. That's soil washing off farms and down major river systems. And that soil, in the bottom of a river or out in an estuary, doesn't grow any crops, and it causes other problems. It's not just soil. We've got nutrients and herbicides traveling with that soil. We've created a dead zone at the mouth of every major river system globally. One of the Mississippi is famous, but there's equivalent ones in Asia, in Europe, in South America. So we're not only losing the productivity off of farmland, we're also destroying the fishery, which is another important source of food for us. So it's kind of a double whammy. So that's the issue that I'd put second. And the frustrating part of it is we know how to farm without losing nearly as much topsoil. Just current practices and economic pressures mean that those practices aren't necessarily used. Is it, you know, soil loss is imperceptible in the short term. It's only the long term where it accumulates into something significant. And then the third piece for me is climate disruption. Agriculture is both a contributor to the climate disruption and is going to be a victim of climate disruption. Where agriculture, depending on who's counting, produces somewhere between 15 and 20% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. But we know how to farm so that agriculture could actually be a sink for carbon. We could be capturing more carbon and storing it in the soil than we're emitting. So agriculture can actually be part of the solution to climate change, but right now it's part of the problem. And as we look forward with the predictions of what's going to happen, you know, we're going to see extended droughts, we're going to see heavier rain events. Both of those things can be very destructive to agriculture and our ability to produce food. So it's something where we need to become part of the solution to try and lessen the impact of climate change. And agriculture could be a material sink of carbon.
Hmm. So you're saying that it's the carbon emissions into the air that then disrupt our climate, that then creates the snow and the rain that then affects the crops. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. I just kind of wanted to recap that.
Yeah, and right now agriculture contributes, you know, 1/5 of the carbon emissions globally. And we could be, we could be a net, we could be pulling more carbon out of the air, so lessening the problem with agriculture, then so we could flip it around. Rather than contributing to the problem, we could be contributing to the solution.
And how would we be doing that?
The solution to both of those problems are kind of, everything's interconnected in agriculture. It's a large, complex ecosystem that we're interfering with, essentially. The biggest change we need to make is move away from tillage and annual monocrop, vast fields of corn and soybeans and wheat, and move to a much more perennial-based agriculture. So if you can envision an ecosystem, whatever pops into your head when I say that word, it's going to have some properties. There's no bare soil in it. The vegetation protects the soil year-round. It's rain-fed. There's nothing pumping water out of the ground into it. It cycles nutrients in place. There's no large factories turning natural gas into nitrogen fertilizer. It's primarily perennials, and there's also animals in that system. Every ecosystem has representatives of all kingdoms in it. So that's a model that's created the soil and the atmosphere that we have over the last however many eons. And we need to get back to something close to that to stop the degradation and have the possibility of actually healing it. So in terms of a diet and what an eater needs to be thinking about is the impact that their food choices are having on the landscape that's growing it. So when we talk about perennials, There's some easy things, you know, most berries, most fruits, most nuts are perennials, not peanuts or tomatoes. So there, it's fairly easy to make perennial choices. On the meat side of things, grass-fed lamb and beef, properly grazed on in outdoor conditions on perennial pastures, is a very ecologically benign way of raising meat. That's not to say that those meats, the way they're currently raised in agriculture, are benign, but there is a system that they can be raised that is benign. And when we look to vegetables, it's a little more challenging, especially up here in Ontario. There's majority of our vegetables are annual crops, but there are a number of things that would substitute well in a diet. For greens, there's a lot of edible perennial leaves, grapevine leaves, leaves of violet, leaves of dandelions, sorrel, number of different things that are actually more nutrient dense than our lettuces. You know, lettuce, you might as well, the nutritional value in most of them can be had by drinking a glass of Metamucil and licking a lawnmower blade. They're large with water and very little nutrition in them. It, you know, the primary benefit to you is the fiber that's in them. So there's the eater can reshape their diet, and then the other piece is they need to get closer to the food that they're eating. So big first step is to start cooking for yourself again. The processing step, A, creates a lot of the emissions from agriculture. It's worse than the transportation piece, but it also makes it completely opaque to the eater where that food came from and what it was, what type of conditions it was produced under. So from my perspective, the biggest benefit of the locavore movement is that it reconnects eaters with the landscape that's growing their food. And
that's true.
And once eaters understand, you know, if they can picture that ecosystem picture in their head, they don't need a lot more understanding to be able to look at a farm and decide whether it's improving the health of that landscape or diminishing it. So, and that relationship doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, you drive to it. You can have that relationship over longer distances as long as you have the relationship and you understand the source and what's going on there.
Well, I'm in California, and on the weekends, sometimes even during the week, in Southern California, a lot of farmers come in for local farmer markets, and they've become extremely popular.
Yes, you've got that incredible advantage of produce year-round. And farmers markets are another great place to start building a relationship with the farmer producing your food. And everything that I've described there also benefits your health. You know, cooking for yourself eliminates a lot of salt and sugar out of your diet, which are the two most toxic additives we have in our food system when you look at the quantity that we're consuming, and it also allows you to chew. It'll automatically put more fruits and vegetables and non-processed food back into your diet. So this is both about healing the planet and improving our own health simultaneously. The two mesh nicely together.
But you, like in your book, you take direct aim at vegetarians and basically state that meat has to be part of our diets to maximize the food production overall and to minimize environmental harm. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes. There's a number of different reasons people choose to be vegetarians, and in most cases I agree with them, whether it's questioning the nutritional value of meat or animal welfare issues, those are all valid concerns with current meat production. What I'm talking about is how do we maximize the amount of food so that we can feed the 9 billion. When you look at agricultural lands globally, about two-thirds of them are rangelands that should stay as rangelands for reasons of topography, geography, brittleness of the ecology of the area. So that rangeland that can harvest sunshine and we can have sheep and cattle convert that into protein and carbohydrate for us. There's a significant portion of the land that we till today that really should be returned to some type of grazing situation. When you look at the damage that's being done to soils and the amount of soil that's being lost, one of the solutions is to return that to grazing. The other piece is the vegetarian diet is held up as environmentally benign. The reality is when I look at conventional agriculture, our vegetables are grown in intensive monocultures, the same as grain crops. And the amount of tillage, the amount of fertilizer, the amount of pesticides that are applied to vegetable fields are far greater than anything I would have used on a corn or soybean field. So there is an environmental cost to producing vegetables, the same with rice, the same with edible beans. They don't get a halo from my perspective. So then the final dimension is pigs and chickens are omnivores and can eat anything that we can eat and digest it. So all of the waste streams that's coming out of our food system could be fed back through pigs and chickens and to create additional food rather than putting that into landfills, compost, what have you. It's got a higher value if it's fed to animals than the alternatives that we're currently doing. When you put all those pieces together, we need herbivores and permanent pastures to maintain the health of the land alongside or as part of an ecosystem in agriculture. So rather than us continuing with this monoculture, hundreds of acres of corn or, in the Central Valley in California, there are the endless fields of vegetables. We have environmental challenges. We have social challenges with how that's raised. We can start to shift and heal those challenges if we start trying to mimic an ecosystem back at the farm. And all ecosystems include animals. They're very good at cycling nutrients. Is one of the great services that they provide in an ecosystem, is accelerating the cycle of nutrients, and we can use that to our benefit.
One of the climate disruption examples today in California is that we're having water shortages up in Northern California, and a lot of the cattle owners are selling off their stock to places like Texas because they don't have the availability of the water to keep, that whole ecosystem going.
Yeah, it's the drought that California is experiencing is of epic proportions. On one hand, on the other hand, the Central Valley qualifies as a desert when you look at the amount of annual rainfall. So the agricultural production in most of the valley is a mirage that's been supported by pumping water out of the aquifers under the ground and diverting all of the snow-fed rivers. I think just about every major river in California is has a substantial portion of its flow diverted for irrigation. So we're now reaping the, I won't say benefit, but our artificial creation is now crumbling down around us. The aquifers are getting drained. We've got, there's going to be some very interesting discussions on water use between agriculture and between the cities. But that's sort of a microcosm of what's going to play out globally. About 70% of fresh water use globally is used in agriculture. It's not used in municipal water systems. So it's unfortunate for the producers that are in the middle of it, but something had to give there eventually.
Yeah, well, 70% of water is used for growing food in the world.
That you can.
That's a huge percentage.
You have a larger impact on water with your diet choices than you do with what kind of toilet you've got in your house.
Yeah, I think in the future, water is going to become a very expensive commodity worldwide. Drinking water, that is.
I'm hopeful that it doesn't become a commodity. There's lots of forces that would like to turn water into a commodity, but I place water as one of those sacred things, right there with oxygen, that we need to find a way to supply and maintain clean water for people without having to put a price on it.
So overall, humanity faces a wide range of problems, when it comes to feeding itself. We have worldwide hunger. You finish your book, Real Dirt, with a sense of optimism. Considering all these challenges that we face going forward, please explain to us how you came to this optimistic view.
I guess it starts out that I'm a farmer, so I have to be an optimist to stick seeds in the ground every spring and expect it to rain and sunshine to get a crop. But when I look at those challenges, yes, they're large. They can appear daunting, but we already have solutions to them. The agricultural systems that I'm talking about, there are people doing it all over the globe. There's millions of acres that are already transitioned to that type of system. So we don't need any technical miracle. We don't need any magic plant to be created. We can do it with what we have. And the other piece that so we've got the technology and the ability. Farmers follow market signals better than any other industry there is. If the market is looking, if people start valuing things more than just cheap and perfect, farmers will respond to that. And the final piece is just the power of the consumer. A lot of people decry the influence of government subsidies and multinational corporations, but consumers spend more on food than all of the others put together. Here in Canada, consumers outspend the government about 10 to 1. It's a $110 billion industry. Consumer at retail, government spends roughly $10 billion in direct payments of one form or another to farmers. So consumers have shaped the food system that we have today. Food system has responded to consumers wanting cheap, wanting convenient, and wanting perfect. So that's the food system that's been created. But if consumers start valuing something other than cheap, perfect, and convenient, they can reshape how agriculture works. We're seeing that at a small scale with with farmers markets and organic production.
True.
And, you know, another example is vegetarian meals and products. You know, there's been an incredible expansion of those offerings because consumers are looking. We can have the same impact if we start valuing the impact on the environment, the welfare of the animals, and the ability to produce food long term. So there's an incredible force that can be harnessed. There's farmers willing on the other side. It's a matter of getting all the junk out of the middle and allowing the consumers to work together for a better future.
Well, Harry Stoddart, I think our listeners have learned a lot today from you. We're running out of time. Why don't you let us know where they can find your book and your farm website address?
Okay, so Real Dirt, an ex-industrial farmer's guide to sustainable eating, is available through all your major online retailers, so Amazon, Barnes & Noble. So that's probably the easiest way for people to get it. You won't find it in your local bookstore, but your local bookstore could order it in for you. It's in their major catalog. So there's a number of channels they can get it, or they can go to my website, realdirt.ca, and I've got links to various sales points for the book there. So it should be easy to find for people online. And then our farm website is just Stoddart to my last name, Stoddart.ca. And you can find a lot of information on what we're doing on our farm, as well as I write posts about various issues in agriculture on the farm website. I have a blog going there as well.
Wonderful. So you're basically, you have your blog, you're a full-time farmer, and then you're a speaker, and you do radio shows. So you're a pretty busy guy.
Yeah, I like to keep life interesting, mix it up a bit.
Well, thank you so much for coming on our show today. And I wish you well with your farming. You do a great service to probably worldwide, because we ship our food all over the world to different countries. And again, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, well, I appreciate the opportunity. I'm always happy to spread the knowledge that I have, and hopefully create a conversation that can move us in a positive direction going forward. So thank you for
the opportunity. It's true. You're welcome. Thank you so much. Okay, listeners, we're about to go on with our second guest. She, her name is Judy Brizendine. She's the author of the book Stunned by Grief, and also a journal. These have both won national and international book awards. She's going to basically teach us how to handle grief, and, you know, not as a negative in our lives, but as a positive, in knowing that things can emerge from it that we probably never could have imagined while we're going through that kind of pain. You know, there's so many challenges that we have in our lives on a daily basis. And one of the things that we never imagine happening to us is the loss of a loved one. And the grief can just be so overwhelming. It can affect us from, you know, the moment we wake up in the morning until we go to bed that night. And I think it's particularly helpful to know how we can, you know, prevent that kind of grief from affecting us and all the people around us at the same time. So I think that this is going to be a great show with Judy. So we're going to just take a short break here, and I'll be right back with you. Thanks. Hello, listeners. I have Judy on the line with us. Hello, Judy.
Hello, Denise.
So great to have you on our show today.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. So I like to ask my guests how they got on the path that they're on today. Obviously, I read your book, and you know, it took a major event in your life, something that you couldn't have imagined. And I suspect that's what happened with you, and that's what motivated you to also write your book.
Yes, absolutely. If you had told me years ago that I'd be on the path I'm on now, I would not have believed it. I would not have thought that it's something that I would want to do. It's certainly nothing I expected or planned for. You know, my life was just fine. Thank you very much. I was going down a path that I thought I'd be on for the rest of my life in a totally different career. And, you know, out of the blue, which happens so many times in our lives, you know, we just go about living our lives and we aren't expecting something, you know, completely unexpected to happen. And for me, it did. Just out of the blue, my husband passed away.
And I'm so sorry.
Thank you. But that happened back in 1998. I was totally unprepared for it. I mm-hmm. knew absolutely nothing about grief at the time, like so many of us, because it's not something that we grow up learning about or talking about. In fact, most people try to steer as far away from it as possible because they're a little bit afraid of it even. And, you know, but when you find yourself in that position, eventually you realize, you know, you have to figure it out, because if you don't, you're not going to make it. You know, it affects your life so profoundly that mm-hmm. You have to figure it out. So, you know, fast forward a number of years, you know, I worked through my grief in a healthy way. Years later, I remarried, and my husband and I, my new husband and I, led grief support groups for a time. And you know, as time went on, initially I didn't have any thought about writing a book, about changing my career. You know, I was very happy in my career. It was something that I had wanted to do for a long time.
What were you doing?
I was an interior designer, and it's something I had wanted to do for many years. And I went back, I had a different degree. And I went back to school, got my degree, started working, and I was a commercial interior designer for around 17 years. I didn't expect to do anything else. But the more the more I thought about what had happened to me, the changes that had taken place, the more I came in contact with people who were facing grief and mm-hmm. not understanding it, and needing answers, you know, at one point I just felt so strongly in my heart that that's something I was supposed to do, that I resigned from my position and I started writing the first book, and one book led to another. And it's just, you know, I understood how important it is for folks to know about grief, because let's face it, loss is part of all of our lives. And if, you know, if you're at the point in your life where you haven't really experienced a deep and profound loss, at some point you will. I mean, it's just inevitable. And what you do with grief and how you understand grief will affect your life not only now but in the future. You know, we have so many misconceptions about grief, and I was no different. You know, it's really very commonplace. People don't understand it, and they don't really find out about it until they have to.
But can people actually go into some form of denial when
they're
suffering grief?
Absolutely. And you know, one thing that is very true too, you know, we have this idea, I mean, we all accept that grief is connected to a loss like death, but somehow we don't really connect grief to other kinds of deep losses. And,
yeah,
you know,
there's
grief
so many.
There are so many. You know, someone can be facing a life-threatening illness. You know, they may lose their home. They may lose their job or the career they've had their entire life. You know, they may have a something might happen to them physically where they're not really able to, you know, to get around to do the things that they were accustomed to doing. You know, they're all, anything that is very, very important to us and we lose it, it's going to produce grief. And if you don't know that there are things that you need to do to work through that grief, and you just try to cover up the pain, you know, ignore it, escape from it, medicate it, whatever it is you try to do to push it aside, it doesn't go away. You know, it doesn't, like so many other people, I thought grief is something that just happens to you when, you know, when something bad happens. It comes and sort of sits on your shoulder for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
When the time is right, it goes away and your life just goes back to normal and that's it. You know, I didn't realize that there was anything I had to do. You know, eventually I found out there was. But the fact is, if you don't face that grief and take care of it, it doesn't go away. And then as other losses happen in your life, this grief accumulates, and it will show up in different places in your life. You know, grief affects everything. It affects your body. Go ahead. No, it affects all parts of your life.
Sure. I kind of wanted to have you give an example of what somebody would do, for instance, you know, they have a loss of a husband or the breakup of a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
What would you recommend would be their process for moving through grief?
First of all, you have to find out what grief is and how it shows up and what it looks like in your life. And you know, the effects of grief are so far reaching. You know, it affects you physically, mentally, emotionally, in relationship with other people, spiritually. It affects everything. And most of us who have been through an experience like that know that, you know, everything just feels totally out of kilter. You know, most people at one point or another will wonder if they're losing their minds because what they're experiencing is so foreign from what is normal that, you know.
Yeah, they're not sleeping, they're not eating.
Or they might be sleeping too much. they might be eating too much. You know, it can go in
either way.
One direction or the other. Yeah, I mean, it's just all over the map, you know. But it'll be things that you aren't accustomed to. So first and foremost, you know, I would say learn something about grief so you know what to expect. So you know that what's happening to you is normal. You know, we all wonder, you know, am I the only one going through this? You know, is what I'm feeling what is common, or, you know, is something wrong with me? And by learning about it, you'll gain a certain level of comfort about what's happening. Realize that it's not just you. You know, other people are feeling the same sorts of things. You're not somehow odd or different. And also, you'll begin to learn what to expect and what to do.
So basically, the book that you wrote called Stunned by Grief, and then you also did a journal, Done by Grief.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote those to help people better identify the grief in their lives and to equip them with the tools to face some of their life's toughest experiences.
Absolutely. You know, if you sit down and read that book, you will understand about grief. You will realize what you have to do. You'll realize that you are not powerless over grief. You know, a lot of people think that they have no control, you know, that grief sort of has them by the neck, so to speak, and they're powerless. That's just not true. And like so many things in life, our attitude makes all the difference in the world. You know, we can put ourselves in a good place. We can put ourselves in a really bad place by the thoughts that we think, by our attitude toward what happens to us. You know, are we going to take on this victim role? You know, why me? Poor me.
Good point.
Why is this happening to me? Or we can decide that, you know, this is normal. This happens to people. I'm going to get through this in a way that is healthy, and I'm going to go on to live a positive life after this. You know, that is totally possible. It's totally something to expect. And there are good things, really good things, that can come out of that grief experience if you look for them. And
it's so true because
accept that.
Yeah, it's really true because, you know, I'm a cancer survivor. And when I was diagnosed, I was diagnosed with not one cancer but two at the same time. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, I just hit the lottery. Isn't this swell? You know, it's like, talk about the challenges, you know, in life. It's like, why? You know, you're like, why? And but I had the choice, like you're saying. Am I going to view this as a negative and hold on to that? Or am I going to view it as a positive in terms of, I guess there's some really big, big changes I need to make in my life, and I need to go off on a whole different direction. And, of course, here I am today as a result.
I'll bet you discovered things about yourself through that process that you didn't know before, good things about yourself.
A lot of good things, but then I also saw some other things that needed to be changed as well.
Mm-hmm. But that's good, too. You know, being able to recognize that, you know, there are things in your life that you want to change for the better because of something that you've been through.
Right. I never dreamed, like you, that I would ever be on the path that I'm on today. You know.
Right.
Like, you know, I'm an award-winning author as well. You know, I have a radio show, but, you know, for probably 20 years I was in the real estate industry.
Mm-hmm. And look how many people you're helping now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, you are too. So I think that, you know, for our listeners, there's two really good examples of how you can turn your life around into a positive versus a negative where you're just going to hang on to that stuff. And unfortunately, at least 90% of people through their lifespan will get over these negative experiences, but there's always going to be that 10% that's going to hang on to it for the rest of their lives. It's that's just the statistics on it.
You know, that's one thing that can become a stumbling block or a roadblock, an obstacle when it comes to grief, and that is not being able or willing to adapt to change. You know, whenever we have a major loss of any kind, change comes along with it. I mean, it's just a fact of life. And, you know, we have to find ways to accept and adapt to those changes if we're going to, you know, process that in a healthy way and move forward, move past it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like you said, unfortunately, there are some people who just for whatever reason cannot or will not accept what has happened and, you know, work through it. They just hang on to that. And it makes me really sad because, you know, it doesn't have to be that way.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about insensitivity or the lack of understanding. Can you expand on that a little bit for our listeners?
Well, oftentimes when someone is going through a grief experience, you know, well-meaning friends and people that you come in contact with will say things to you that are very hurtful. They don't say those things because they want to hurt you. You know, they don't say those things to be unkind. When they say things like that, it's just because they don't understand. You know, they don't understand grief. And quite honestly, if you haven't been through a major grief experience, you won't understand. I didn't. You know, you have no way of understanding if you haven't been through it. So if somebody
who
says
helped
something,
you?
Who helped me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went to some months in after my husband died. I went to a grief support group, which was a wonderful, wonderful thing. I learned a lot. I, you know, connected with other people who were going through the same thing, and you know, that's a very supportive environment. You know, one thing that we didn't. All we really talked about was learning about grief, but there are other things that you have to do, and talking about your experience is one of them. You know, crying, experiencing those emotions, whatever they are, is another one.
Mm-hmm.
And a grief support group is a very safe place where you can go and do all those things and be comfortable because that's accepted there. You know, everyone's in the same place, and you're actually encouraged to do those things that will help you to work through your pain and everything that accompanies your loss. But I went to a grief support group. That was probably one of the major things, and connecting with other people who were going through it. And I was continuing to learn on my own about grief. I was reading books. I was... you know, educating myself because I needed to know what to expect. And if what I was going through was normal, you know, I didn't have another widow to talk to. I wish I had at the time. You know, there were things that I wanted to know, and I didn't have a direct person to ask. You know, so I spent a lot of time reading and trying to learn on my own. So, you know, so I had a good idea about what I needed to do.
Interesting. Yeah, I was really curious what your process was on that.
Well,
so obviously
thing,
through all the books that you read and then your grief counseling, you probably ended up with a library of books to kind of help you write yours.
I have tons of books. Journaling is another wonderful, wonderful way of working through your grief. And I did journal, and, you know, that was one reason I ended up writing the journal, because that is such a powerful way to help work through all of those grief feelings, especially don't have a group to go to, because many people don't, you know, in lots of areas there are no groups available. Well, journaling is a way that you can work through all of that on your own. It's a very powerful tool.
So if one of us has a loved one that or a friend who's going through grief, the things that you just talked about, the support groups and reading, besides those, is there any other way that, for instance, we could help them besides those two things?
You can be available. You know, one of the things that is so needed is someone who's going through a loss needs to talk. You know, they need to talk about their feelings. They need to talk about what's happened. They need to be able to verbalize that. And by doing that, they're actually working through and releasing those feelings that they have deep inside. It's difficult. You know, at first, there are people around who are willing to listen. But quite honestly, most people don't understand that much about grief, and they think that within a few weeks you should be over it. You know, certainly if
you hurry up now.
You should put it behind you, and, you know, you should be just fine. Well, that's not the way it works. And so pretty soon there aren't people around who are willing to listen. In fact, you know, they get real tired of you wanting to talk about it. So one of the biggest gifts that you can give to someone who's going through grief is to let them know that you're there if they need to talk.
Okay.
You know, I would hope that anyone who's going through grief would be sensitive to that and not, you know, not take advantage of it. But just knowing that there's someone there that you can talk to if you're willing to is just invaluable, because there aren't too many places anyone can go to talk.
Well, and when you say take advantage of it, what do you mean?
I mean, don't just, if they have offered to be a soundboard for you, don't take advantage of their generosity. You know, realize that, you know, you have to put some limits on that yourself.
So in other words, the length of the phone calls or the visits or how many, kind of thing?
Yes. I mean, be sensitive to that. Don't take advantage of their generosity. You know, when you really need to talk, then call and say, you know, I really need to talk. But don't be calling them every day, you know, five times a day. Just, you know, use your good sense.
Inaccessible.
And be,
What is someone that's grieving? What do they need the most? What we're talking about?
They need that for sure. But what they need to know that somebody really cares, that somebody recognizes and acknowledges, you know, what they're going through. And that just that they really care, because grief can be extremely isolating, even among people that you love, you know, that you love, your best friends, your family. There's just a way of it isolating you from other people. You feel different. Feel a lot of times like you don't exactly belong the way you used to. And just knowing that there's someone who truly, truly cares means the world. I mean, for months after my husband died, I would receive, you know, a note or a card in the mail from people that he worked with that I didn't even know. you know, just writing, sending a note saying we're thinking about you, you know, we care. That, and usually those would come at a really critical time when I really needed to know that they cared, you know, was this kind of feeling really down. But those kind of things just meant the world. Or a phone call from out of the blue, you know, I'm thinking about you. Just, you know, you're on my mind, you're on my heart, I just want you to know I care. Is there anything that you need that I could do? You know, something like that. Those kind of things are invaluable, just invaluable.
Is it something that will eventually fade away if you don't go to the support groups and you don't read the books?
Well, I don't think there's a one size fits all. I mean, not a support group is not necessarily right for everyone. You know, some people feel more comfortable in seeing a therapist or a grief counselor. You know, there are all kinds of different things that are right for different people. But the point is, you have to do something to work through that pain, to face it, to allow yourself to feel whatever those emotions are, you know, whether they're anger, you know, deep pain and sadness, whatever they are, you know, you have to allow yourself to feel those things and to work through them and then get to a place where you can accept, because it doesn't come right away, you know, accept what's happened, the reality of what's happened, to, you know, let go of that grief, not the person, you know, not forgetting, that's not what I mean, but, you know, letting go of what's happened and then opening your heart up to, you know, to the future, to living again, to loving again, to embracing life again. You know, there's a whole series of things that have to happen, and, you know, you have to work your way through that, whether it's through journaling, you know, talking to other people, being in a group, counseling, whatever combination of those things works for you. And for everyone, it's different, just like we're all different. But there is that process that has to happen to go full circle through that.
How many total years did it take you to get over the loss of your husband and your father?
I would say about 3.5 years.
3.5 years. Long time.
But again, you know, it's different for everybody. You know, sometimes there were some people who came to a grief support group that we led that had lost a spouse 7 years before. I mean, it's different for every person in every situation, and there is no right or wrong. You know, it's what's
right.
But
don't you think there's a point, though, if somebody's hanging on to it for 15 or 20 years, that's an issue?
Yes, I do. I do for sure.
Of course, I don't know what they would do at that point because they haven't found their path for, you know, being positive about it and getting over it. You know, they may be the ones that are in that 10% of the population that just never, ever will.
Who just are unwilling or unable for whatever reason.
We don't and we can't walk in their footsteps, you know, to know all the circumstances, so you can't, you know, you can only feel empathy for them.
Yeah, and, you know, we don't know what led up to that event, you know, that really, you know, put them over, well, you know, we just don't know. We just don't know.
Exactly. Sometimes life just sucks.
Sometimes it does.
No way around it.
No. I mean, I will tell you that, you know, when my husband died, going through all that was the most painful, the most difficult thing that I faced in life. But, you know, that wasn't the end. And I made a decision way back, you know, right after that happened to me, that I was not going to be bitter and that I was not going to let his death be a tragedy that destroyed the rest of my life. And I really think that, you know, setting my mind way back then really helped me to get through some times, you know, that were really tough when I, you know, when I did fall back and, you know, I was struggling. It's like I never forgot where I was going because I, you know, I knew that that there was more life for me, that there were things that, you know, that God had for me to do, that I had a purpose still. And, you know, at that time I didn't know what my purpose was. I was just trying to get through the day. But, you know, I knew that there was still life to live. And I was determined that that life was going to be good.
Let's talk a little bit about your journal. If somebody can't afford to buy both your book and the journal, which one would you recommend? And then also, the journal is like a kind of a working, that's the tool that's kind of the working tool where it's more personal. You can sit and work your issues out. You kind of guide the reader through the steps. You call it remapping.
Right. Well, again, I think it would depend on the individual. If there was no group to go to and if someone felt comfortable, you know, writing, and this is just like pouring your heart out on paper. It's not, you know, some perfect kind of composition that you do. It's just, and there aren't questions to answer. It's just really, you know, there's a topic for each day that has to do with something about grief, and it's just really pouring your heart out on paper about whatever's in your head and in your heart. So, but you can do some of that with the book too, because at the end of every chapter there's a question or two that, you know, that would be a topic for journaling. There are a few questions in another part of the book for journaling. So the book goes more in depth, obviously, about, you know, grief itself, and there are stories and examples of real people in all sorts of different circumstances, different ages, different, you know, every just very different stories that people can relate to. They'll see themselves in all sorts of different ways through the experiences of others. So if you want to, you know, get into it a little deeper, then I would say the book. If you want kind of a light touch and you, you know, you'll do the writing, then I would say the journal. But the book is a very easy read. It's, you know, there's lots of white space. There are breakout boxes and things that you can just go to and grab onto things that will help you in your journey. You don't have to read it straight through. You can just go to the topic that you're dealing with and look at that if you're not, you know, in a position where you feel like you want to read very much. So, you know, I think it's very personal as to, you know, your own, what you feel would be best, the best approach for you.
Well, there's no doubt you put a great deal of work and thought into both your book and the journal. I don't know how long it took you. How long did it take you to write both of these?
Probably about a year and a half, 2 years. But they underwent,
so I thought.
The book particularly underwent about 4 complete revisions before it got to the point, you know, where it is now. But I just wanted to give people the most transparent look at grief and what it is, and, you know, to give them a one kind of a one place they could go and just find out what they needed to know and not have to look 10 different places. You know, if you want to read other books, there are tons of them on the market, and you can do that. But when you're in the midst of all that, and you're not really in a place where you want to research, you know, all kinds of different places, you've got a place that you can go and get a really good idea about what's happening to you, what to expect and what to do. And you know, I want it to make it as simple, as easy, but yet as complete and real, you know, as I could possibly make, because I wish I had had that at the time.
I can relate to that. Oh, gosh. So why don't you tell our listeners where they can purchase these, the book and the journal, and your website, and your, I guess you write a blog. Is that current, your blog?
Yes, it is. There are about 60-some-odd articles on the blog about all sorts of issues, questions, concerns, fears, you know, about grief, all different topics.
Oh, I think that'd be quite valuable. So give us the websites of both, and then also where they can purchase your books.
Well, you can find everything at stunnedbygrief.com. There are links on the website where you can purchase the journal either directly from us, from Amazon, from Barnes & Noble, you know, other online bookstores, and the blog is part of that website. People can get in touch with me through the website. The email will come directly to me. No one else will see it. And I read and answer the email that I get. So just about everything that you would need, that you'd be looking for, you can find on the website, stunnedbygrief.com.
It's a great name.
Well, it described better than anything that I could come up with what it felt like. Stunned.
Do you give speeches in front of groups?
I love to speak whenever I have the opportunity, because I just have such a passion about this topic, and I think I know how important it is, because it, you know, what people understand and do with grief affects their lives not only now but in the future. You know, it's really critical. And, you know, I'm always happy to be able to share whenever I have the opportunity.
Well, on behalf of myself and our listeners, thank you so much, Judy Breisendine, for being on our show today. And I wish you well in everything that you do.
Thank you so much. It was great to be with you, and I'm just very happy to meet you.
Thank you so much. Okay, listeners, please join us again next Wednesday at 4 o'clock p.m. or 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time for another great show. And I look forward to presenting you with some new topics to learn by.
We celebrate our listeners worldwide and invite you to contact Denise at www.healthmedianow.com with any questions you may have, and follow her on Twitter at Health Media Now and Facebook at Health Media Now. For those interested in an advertising campaign on her show, contact Lisa at knowledgeworkspub.com. Be sure to visit gotcancernowwhat.com for information on Denise Messenger's award-winning book, Got Cancer, Now What?
Listeners, I just wanted to remind you that the entire contents of this radio show, they're based upon the opinions of Denise and her guests. This information on the show, it's not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, and it's not intended as medical advice. It's strictly intended as a sharing of knowledge and information from our guests and the experiences of Denise and her community. We encourage you to make your own healthcare decisions based upon your research and in partnership with a qualified healthcare professional of your choice. These statements They have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Thank you and good night.